Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone, and welcome to session 6 of When Your Kids Push Your Buttons. This session, we're talking about how your beliefs serve you. What do you mean, serve me? They don't serve me at all, is what I hear from parents when we get to this section of the program. Well, then why is it so hard to change them? We'll look at the whys in a bit, but the most important recognition is that we do, in fact, hang on to the negative limiting beliefs we hold about ourselves because we need them. Once we can let go of the need, we can let go of the beliefs, the ones we heard on the other side of the gap, the ones that drive us to parent in the ways that we hate. First, I want to spend a little more time on identifying those beliefs and making sure that you've recognized ones you have about yourself. So, can I have a volunteer to go over the complete the sentence exercise on page 31? Anyone want to volunteer to go over that with me? Or the homework on page 32, either one. All right, Sabina, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So are you want to do this?
Yes, I do.
Good. Okay.
So when I was a child, the message I often heard from my parents when they were frustrated or angry with me was, and I had three different points that I wrote down.
Good. Yeah.
So the first one, which I remember the most, was, why can't you be like, the person changed. It could be my brother.
Yeah.
It could be a neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one was, do you know how good you have it? Like people are starving, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the third one was, what will the neighbors think?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I think I basically focused on why can't you be like for the rest of the exercise.
Okay.
The message I took in about myself was that I was not good enough, was not smart enough, always had to try harder, behave appropriately. This belief continues to drive me in my parenting whenever my buttons get pushed by leading me to yell at my son when he doesn't do what I ask after a couple requests because I want him to do it straight away pretty much and do it correctly. I wouldn't get mad if this was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realize now that what my parents intended on the other side of the gap was for me to aim higher, to achieve more, to be a good student, and a good, responsible person.
Right.
So what I believe about myself, what I believed about myself as a child was not true. I can now look at the situation and see that I am, in fact, find the way I am and have achieved quite a lot. I do what I want. I do what I feel is right for me, not what everyone else is doing.
All right. Does that feel true to you?
The end statement?
The end, yeah.
For the most part, yeah.
Good. We just want to make sure that, you know, we're not trying to sell ourselves another bill of goods.
Yeah.
That it really feels like we can believe it.
Yeah.
So that's great. Thanks a lot, Sabina, for sharing that. Do we have someone else who would like to volunteer and exercise? Anyone else? Nobody's volunteering today. Sabina, did you do the exercise on page 32 to answer the questions?
32, no, I did not.
Okay. Well,
no, I didn't. let's see.
Do you want to go through it?
Yeah, we could do it. When I was waiting on the line, I did read it, the questions, and I was thinking, wow, those are difficult questions.
Yeah, they are. Well, it's another way. You know, some people feel the complete the sentence is difficult, too.
Yeah.
So can you think of a certain incident or a more generalized group of incidents in which you got some of these messages that you stated in the other exercise?
I don't remember any specific incident. I just remember those words, like hearing them often about,
uh-huh.
you know, how good you have it,
yeah.
and why can't you be like, and what will the neighbors think? And I don't even know what I was doing to think, like, what are the neighbors going to say? Like, who cares what the neighbors think?
Right.
I can't remember doing anything that bad to have to worry about what anybody else is thinking.
Right. So when you heard one or more of those, did you make a decision about yourself? Are you aware of what you decided to believe about yourself based on what your parents said?
No, I don't think it was an awareness that, wow, I guess I'm not good enough. But I think if you hear it enough, you start to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even think my parents meant to do that. You know, they
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Why we talked about in the other exercise, what you can now see was your parents' intention.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, we don't intend to give those messages to our children, do we?
No.
Yeah.
But if you keep hearing that type of thing, then that's your conclusion.
Right. Exactly. So do you feel that you have pretty much gotten out from under those beliefs, or can you answer this next one? How do they affect your life today in general?
I don't know about the second question. What did you decide to believe about yourself based on this, and why? The thing is how do these beliefs affect you in life today in general? It's only going to be coming out now as when I'm parenting,
yeah.
and taking a course like this that you're realizing, hey,
right,
you know, I better watch what I say, otherwise my son's going to get, like, you know, he's going to have a lack of confidence or something.
Mhm. And do you think you have a lack of confidence?
I would say that I'm very cautious, and I wouldn't take risks. Now, if you interpret it as a lack of confidence, like, you could, but to me, I'm also like, I like to rationalize. I like to make an informed decision,
right.
and then I'll do it.
Right.
But I wouldn't. A lack of confidence. I don't think I have a lack of confidence.
You feel like you have a lack of confidence in your parenting.
Yes, I want to make sure that I'm doing the best that I can,
mm-hmm.
because it's only me.
And
I feel it's a big responsibility.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I find it's a big responsibility, and I want to make sure I'm doing the best that I can.
And when you get your buttons pushed, where do you go? What are some of the assumptions, those fears and assumptions that you make?
I think the assumption of, you know, you have to get it right, or
mm-hmm.
you should know better.
Okay.
That type of thing, and the I think the what will the neighbors think? Like, I am very cautious of my son's behavior around other people and thinking
in public
what they think. Like,
mm-hmm.
oh, well, like, why isn't he right. listening to you? Like, there he goes, just takes off. but right now I'm trying to turn it around and think, that's like, he's a kid. That's what he's supposed to be doing.
Right.
And not worry so much about what other people are thinking.
understood. So, yes, that place of you have to get it right. So if your child isn't getting it right, whatever that means, that's, of course, your
mm-hmm.
perception of
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not happening, then you tend to react and control.
Well, yeah. Well, I would react. I would get annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about, like, control. Like, for
any
instance...
fears come up about what will happen?
Sorry?
Any fears come up about what will happen if he doesn't get it right?
I don't know if it gets that far. I think I get stuck in probably why isn't he getting it right? And
right.
Let's take and to me, when I'm talking about it, and I'm going to tell you, I'm like thinking he's only learning, so he's out of diapers. Say he's standing and urinating.
Okay.
And it goes out of the toilet.
Talking about a 3.5-year-old.
Right. Right. Right now, so what I'm telling you, I'm thinking he's only learning, and I should be more patient.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes he'll say, look, Mommy, if I don't touch my penis, I don't have to wash my hands. And I'm like, no, Chase, don't do that. Right? Because if he's got less control if he doesn't hold on to it, and then he'll pee outside of the bowl.
Mm.
And that'll annoy me.
Mm. So he's not doing it right.
Sometimes.
Right. So, yeah, these are just, you know, it's just, I think, important to just be aware of those times when these kind of threads come through. But it also sounds like you've gotten some awareness, you've had some awareness, and you kind of understand the process.
I am trying hard, but sometimes I go over the weekend, I'm thinking, geez, I don't know. I don't think I'm getting this course, because I do. Like, I tend to kind of fly off the handle.
Well, these are the times when you fly off the handle, these are the times that button is getting pushed. And if it has to do with making sure that your children get it right, do it right, do it, you know, so that it could be you had to do it right because you got the message that you weren't good enough and that
mm-hmm.
you weren't as good as,
mm-hmm.
and so you want your children not to suffer that, so get it right in the first place
mm-hmm.
so you won't have to suffer that, which is another way of reacting to the belief. Or you worked very hard to get it right as a child, so you wouldn't have those disparaging remarks.
Yeah.
And if you could do it, why can't your son?
But his age.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. I don't remember that age.
Right. Of course not.
So I don't know what went. I'm thinking, geez, was I hounded about these things when I was that age?
Well, it, you know, brings up those questions, doesn't it? Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's asking yourself what's important. Is it really important that he learn to, you know, pee exactly correctly right now? And what else is it important that he learn to do just right? Or can I just let it go and let him be 3.5?
Yeah. I'm trying hard to do that because I know that's the answer. That's he's only 3.5.
Right.
I'm thinking, gosh, I'm used to being around adults. I'm not used to being around a 3.5-year-old or a baby as it were. And my expectations are probably very high, but he too is very, sometimes when he's talking to me, it's like talking to an adult. You know what I mean? I find that he's very, and when he does pee, he'll say, I'm sorry, Mommy, that was an accident. It was an accident. I say, I know, Chase, it's okay.
So what is he apologizing for?
Like say he pees out or say he, he
doesn't
has a sip of water in the kitchen and spills some water. He just He'll say sorry.
And so I think that's a situation in which you clues you in that he is very aware he's doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So you want to just let up on anything that you say to him that might give him the message that he's doing it wrong. You know, a lot of people will say, well, great, you're teaching him that he knows how to do it right. But it also sounds like there's some pressure. He's got to say, sorry, Mommy.
Yeah.
And you have to judge it for yourself. I can't judge it from here.
Mm-hmm.
But just something to ask yourself. Is he feeling pressure to be perfect? Is he feeling pressure to get it just right? And I think that, you know, if that's true, then that certainly is connected to your pressure to get it right and to not be compared to others and to be someone respectable if the neighbors overhear and mm-hmm. on and on. So just being aware, that's really all there is to do.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else who has come on interested in doing one of the exercises on page 30 or 31? 31 or 32? No one's daring. Okay, I'm going to move on then. And I wonder if people are feeling kind of hopeless at this point. We talked a little bit about this last week, and this is usually the stage in the program where parents feel hopeless. I even titled chapter 19 in the book, Just When It Feels So Hopeless. So if you're there, if you felt like you couldn't do the exercises, it is a normal situation. Sheila wrote to me that she's aware that her old reactivated self has come back since she started part two and is wondering if that just means things are getting stirred up for her, but she's feeling very frustrated. And, Sheila, that's normal. Now you see what the problem is, but you don't see the solution. Of course you're going to feel frustrated and hopeless. This is a normal stage of progression. You've had how many years of training during your upbringing? How old are you? And so far, 5 hour-and-a-half sessions to reverse all that. Really. It doesn't happen that easily. There is no solution. There's just improved consciousness. We're not changing your childhoods here. We're raising our consciousness. Remember that dimmer switch to see how our beliefs and patterns get passed on so you can stop passing them on to your children. There are 4 stages of parenting that I talk about at this point. The first stage is unconscious incompetency. That's when you're just kind of flying by the seat of your pants and you don't know any other way and it's kind of like the don't tell me how to parent, stay out of my way, what was good enough for me is good enough for my kids. That's kind of that unconscious, incompetent stage of parenting. The second stage is conscious incompetency. Conscious incompetency means that you have become very aware of what it is you want to do differently and finding frustrating times when you can't do it, but you know what you want to do. So that's a place that a lot of you are probably feeling stuck right now, that, why can't I get this place? And the third stage is conscious competency. And I am guessing that you fluctuate back and forth between these. The conscious competency is that place where you are working really hard. You're aware, you're paying attention, you're thinking about it really well, and you're doing it sometimes. And unconscious incompetency is the final stage. That is when all your automatics have shifted to new automatics and you don't have to think about it anymore. You would no more say or do things that you did or said before you learned what you've learned than fly to the moon. And that's when it becomes so easy. That's when it starts to really become effortless, and there's so much enjoyment in parenting, even when you're having problems. Annabelle wrote in and said that she finds the structure of the material very useful and will use it to go over a reaction she's had if she hasn't caught it in time. Now, that is an example of conscious competency. That is where I'm hoping that you're all becoming, you know, getting into that place of using the material, of being able to go back over a situation and think it through. So I don't think Annabelle is on the line. Are you, Annabelle, to give us an example? I don't think she's here. Anybody else who's come on the line want to volunteer one of your exercises for homework? Alana, right?
Yes.
Okay, Alana, great. Would you like to do your complete the sentence?
Yeah, I know there was two.
Yes, there's 31 and 32.
And 32, okay.
Which one would you like to do?
Okay, yeah, the 31. I kind of got stuck on the I realized that now that my parent intended, that's the one I got stuck on. But I did all the rest before that.
Okay, well, let's give it a go.
All right, so when I was a child, the message I often heard from my parents when they were frustrated or angry with me was, "You're so stupid. Why can't you be more like such and such daughter?" The message I took in about myself was that I'm not smart. I'm not good enough. This belief continues to drive me in my parenting whenever my buttons gets pushed by leading me to think that my kids are stupid, and then I get mad at them when they make mistakes because I don't want them to make mistakes and feel stupid like I did. If they didn't make mistakes, I wouldn't get mad.
Uh-huh. Right. This is not unlike Sabina's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sorry, I just got on.
Yeah.
And then that's where I got stuck. I realized now that what my parent intended was on the other side of the gap was she was disappointed that I wasn't smart enough, but it doesn't seem like that.
Why do you think she told you weren't smart? Was she trying to motivate you in some way?
Well,
or just put you down?
Well, I think it was a part of a projecting because I didn't know it at the time, but when I grew up, I found out that she only had a third grade education because her dad passed away, and in Korea you have to pay for school, and so her parents didn't have enough, or her mom did not have enough money to keep continuing to send her to school, so she couldn't go. So I think she felt not smart because of that, so sort of projecting it on me. But, you know, when I was younger, of course I didn't understand that.
Of course not, no.
Yeah.
This is your thinking now, right?
Right, right.
So this helps you, you know, when you put your adult thinking on the situation, you're making new pictures and you're having some compassion for where your parent might be coming from, and then read the next line.
So what I believe in myself as a child was not true. I can now look at the situation and see that I am in fact.
So you see, when you look at the situation
mm-hmm.
of maybe projection on your mother's part, the fact that she came from a very difficult background and felt stupid herself and possibly projected that onto you because she felt so inadequate she couldn't, you know, she couldn't really own that.
Right.
Or possibly she was motivating you by telling you you weren't smart enough to make you get smart
mm.
so you didn't experience the pain that she did.
Right.
Right?
Ah, okay. That mm. sounds... I like that one much better.
Well, good. Well, you see, what I believe, that whatever rings true
mm-hmm.
is hitting something, an old memory stored in your cells, you know, that you may not remember consciously, but I think when something rings true, that is an aha.
Yes.
So either way, what you believed about your, if you see this, if you see it this way from this point of view, you can then understand that what you believed about yourself as a child, that you were mm-hmm. stupid, you weren't good enough, was not true.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, and maybe you haven't gotten here yet, did you fill this in?
No, because I was stuck on the one before that.
Right. So now what you want to do is look at it, is just spend some time
mm-hmm.
taking in that, in fact, this was not true. And what does that mean? What does
right.
that mean for you? How can you relook at yourself? You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I definitely need time to process that.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
All right, but do keep that and come back to it and fill that in for yourself later on when you've processed it.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Great. And Sheila. Sheila, are
yes.
you there? Hi.
Yes. Oh, well, that was really great. I love it when people share, because here's my share. I didn't do the homework, and I have been really resistant to doing it. So I think I'm in
conscious incompetency stage.
Conscious incompetence, and it was really bugging me.
Yeah.
And because remember, I was like super mommy just a little while ago, and now my buttons are being pushed all over the place. And something my husband said when I was doing, you know, well, with quotation marks around it,
mm-hmm.
he's like, well, I hope it lasts.
Yes.
It really
Ooh,
made me mad. God. Anyway. Yeah. But you know, it kind of didn't. I mean, I know I'm in a process, but it really helps when people share, because it's unsticking me. You know, because there's like just this part, this resistance. I didn't even look at the homework. Yeah, I
mm-hmm.
took it with me. I took it all around,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the car, and I was going to do it here and there, and I just didn't do it. So it's really a missed opportunity, because just by hearing the other mom share, I feel so moved, and I'm feeling like I can do this. You know, I can.
Well, Sheila, let
I
me say, yeah, let me say that I am really glad that you shared that, because I am sure you are speaking for many other people on this call,
right.
whether they're on live or will be listening to the recording. And it's really helpful for other people to hear that. And we come to it, you know, in our time. And I think it's well worth your recognition that you were resistant to doing it. Not to put yourself down, not to say, I'm lazy, what's wrong with me, why can't I get with the program, yada, yada, yada. But to just recognize that it is something you're resisting, your buttons are getting repushed, and you are in a process. And that is exactly where you are. You are in a process. And so I really thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. It's very uncomfortable. I hate being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's just actually what is a big motivator for me is to not be uncomfortable. And when I'm not parenting the way I want, that's worse than this. So I will do my homework. I will do it today with everybody on the class. And I'm going to do today, you know, this, what we did, what we're supposed to do last week, and I'm going to do next week's today.
Okay.
So that I have the benefit of a whole week, because I really want to get back to that blissful state of not reacting. It's such a relief, and it's so wonderful.
Well, you know it's there. You know you've experienced it, so you know you can do it.
I have to. I really want to. Okay, so that's...
All right.
Thank you,
Sheila.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
So it's important for all of you to understand that we are not working for perfection here, right? This is a process. Every one of you is at a different stage of the process, and it's very important that you have patience and that you have compassion for yourself. Next week we're going to talk a lot more about that, because if you don't have compassion for yourself, if you don't have patience with yourself, how are you going to have it for your kids? If you expect yourself to be perfect, if you expect yourself to get it right all the time, and maybe because of a message you got from your background, then you're going to pass that on. And we're going to talk a little more about that right now in a section that I call spellcasting. Now, don't worry, I'm not getting really weird on you, but this became very clear to me at one point quite a long time ago in teaching the program, and I learned it from another program I was taking. The beliefs that we hold on to, the beliefs we hold on to are like spells that we are under from our past, both positive and negative. The assumptions that we make about our children and the expectations we hold of them are the spells that we cast on them, both positive and negative. So let me say a little more about that, because I'm probably confusing you all. When we are under a spell of feeling stupid, feeling not good enough, thinking that we're unloved, that carry on with us, that stay with us, it's like being in a spell, right? Think about the gap now. When your parent was saying certain things to you over and over again, what will the neighbors think? Why can't you be more like? All of that is casting a spell on you. Now, some of us stay under the spell for reasons that we had when we were children. Some of us don't, but those spells are there. So I'm going to ask some questions here just for you to think about. What spells are you still under? From your parents, your siblings, your teachers, both good and bad. Were you the pretty one? Stupid, charismatic, fat? Why do you stay under the bad spell? Why do you give them the power over you? Because that's what we do. When we're under a spell, that spell has power over us. We have no choice in the matter. Do you keep the spell active in order to blame your parents? What spells have you released yourself from? And how? What spells do you hold your children under? And how can you break them? Any questions from any of you about that? Okay. This is where our boundaries come in. Now, I use the word boundaries different as being a different idea than limits. Some people use boundaries to mean limits. I talk about boundaries in a more psychological way. Our boundaries are separate us from others in terms of our problems, our issues, our responsibilities. So on my side of the boundary, I have my problems, my responsibilities, my issues, and I take responsibility for them. I don't ask my child to take them for me. I don't ask my child to make my life easier and better. I don't ask my child to make me look like a good parent. And on my child's side of the boundary, he is with his problems, his issues, his responsibilities. And I don't, if I have good boundaries, I don't fix his problems. I don't get into his problems with him. I don't punish him to force him to fix them. I don't take responsibility for what is his so that he doesn't learn to take responsibility. This is the area where it gets really subtle and where I call, this is where I see the art of parenting, because I really do think parenting is an art. And when we didn't have boundaries growing up, when our parents didn't hold good boundaries between us, when we felt responsible for our parents' happiness and any emotion they were having was because of me, then that means my parent did not hold a good boundary with me. So that means I have to make them up from scratch. I have to learn about boundaries. So we're owning our problems and responsibilities and not asking our children to take care of them. When I say or think, you make me so mad, I am telling my child that you're responsible for my emotions. Versus allowing my child to own his problems and responsibilities and not rescuing him and fixing him and thinking it's my job to make him happy. See, that's one of the big responsibilities we need to let go of. It is not our responsibility to make our children happy. That is a really big one. Now, this does not mean I wash my hands of you. You're on your own. This does not mean, tough kiddo, that's your problem, you go fix it. When we can keep a good, clear, healthy boundary, we can and we want to help each other with our problems. But you see, the key word here is help, not take responsibility, not fix. It's help. We are much better able to help our children with their problems when we don't take responsibility for them. If I take responsibility for my son's problem of not being able to stand up for himself, of not being able to of having a lot of fears and anxieties. When I take responsibility for those things, that means I've got to make them go away. I've got to make sure that he's no longer anxious. I've got to make sure that that he's doing it the right way. So it's my problem, and therefore, if he remains anxious, if he doesn't do it the right way, then guess whose fault it is? Mine. And so that keeps me tied in very strongly, very powerfully, very emotionally to my child's problems if I think I have to make them go away. And I think I may have shared with you how I was able to let go of the problems my daughter was having with her pain and her sadness over so many things when she was little. And when I was able to realize this is her life, this is her journey, this is her sadness, this is her pain, then I was so much more able to effectively help her in her problem. When I took responsibility for her, and then I was all upset when she was upset, then she had my upset to deal with as well as her own. So you want to be a good sounding board for your child. And in order to be a sounding board, it's very important that you can disengage from your child's problems so you can really be there as a help. I often use the image of a sounding board as if any of you have played tennis against a backboard when you're alone playing tennis, you hit the ball against the backboard and it bounces back to you, right? So that's kind of the image I use as a sounding board. Other people use different things. So what that means is when my child is upset, when my child is having a problem, when my child is screaming at me or about someone or something else, I can let those words and behaviors bounce off me and back to my child so my child can hear herself, right? So, I mean, think of therapy. That's really what good therapy is all about. We have the opportunity to really hear ourselves complain and moan and groan and get angry and frustrated and sad and all of those things that we get. So when I am a sounding board for my child, then my child is better able to see what she's saying and doing. When I'm not reacting, when I'm reacting and saying, well, how do you think she feels when you hit her? Or how would you feel if somebody hit you? Or that's not okay, don't do that. That's, you know, we're constantly teaching. And I'm not saying never do that, but, you know, when we say to a child, how do you think so-and-so feels? It's a little iffy, because then what I'm saying to my child, a pretty young child, I'm saying, I care more about that other person than I do about you. So we want to be, at least initially, let all that out, let our children's upsets and emotions out, and just listen, just hear, just be there, and maybe acknowledge with some nods and ahas, and then you can get to validating. So, it sounds like you're really, really angry. And, yeah, I can hear the frustration in your voice. Or, I know just what you mean. I felt like that too. So you're being this, you're not telling your child what to do. You're not giving your advice yet. You're making connection. So let's take an example. Your child calls you stupid. For some, that's not a button, and it's easy to deflect. For others, perhaps Alana, it is. And it's taken personally because it's a reminder of a time when we we felt stupid in the eyes of a parent or a teacher and took on that belief, right? So if you hold a belief, I'm not smart enough, I'm not capable enough to do that, I can't, and your child is angry at you and screams, you're so stupid, boom, that's going to hit a button. That is going to trigger you. Your assumption might be something like, oh, he's so disrespectful and rude, which, of course, leads you to feeling angry and rageful and react. So the word stupid is all you see. Put it in the tip of the iceberg to see why your child might be saying it. Reframe your assumption to, he's feeling really angry at me right now. When we can do that, we switch it back. It turns it around and switches it back to his problem on his side of the boundary. He's the one who's upset. So it's his problem, not yours. It's not about you nearly as much as it is about him. So when you can deflect it, he will calm, and later, if need be, you can address not liking to be called stupid. You can maybe do that with a do-over. A do-over is what you can do when you've reacted, when you've had a button-pushing situation, when you haven't handled it well, and you know it. And you wait until all emotions are calm. Maybe it's later that day. Maybe it's the next day. Maybe it's a week later. And then you go back and do a do-over. And you might say to your child, do you remember yesterday when I got really angry? You told me I was stupid and I flew off the handle. I was not able to hear you. I was so angry then. I was not able to hear what you were trying to tell me. I'm calm now, and I would like to know what you were trying to tell me. You can tell me now. Maybe that's for a little older child. Or you can say, I don't like the way I reacted. Here's what I wish I had said or done. And then say it. Tell your child what you wish you had said or done. What incredible modeling that is for owning a mistake and problem solving it, redoing it. And you may or may not, depending on the circumstance, you may or may not say to your child, is there anything you wish you had said or done? This is the time when you're going to get amends, because children love to make amends, but when we punish them, when we blame them, we don't give them the opportunity to make amends. They just get so angry and outraged by the punishment and the blame, or so guilt-ridden, or so whatever, that amends don't come so easily. So if your button is being pushed, then you're still under the stupid spell. And it is a stupid spell. And if you keep reacting to your child as though he's being disrespectful and rude and you're reacting in anger, that is the spell you're casting on your child. And then it becomes up to him and his temperament whether or not he believes he's disrespectful, and what he chooses to do with that. Questions, thoughts, comments? Okay, Alana, yes.
How about much more harsh, like swearing words when they swear at you? Is it the same as...
When they swear at you.
Yeah, I mean the F word and the...
When
in public...
Yeah, in public too.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, especially in public,
mm-hmm.
I think it's very important to not react.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you can say calmly, I do not like to be spoken to like that. You don't want to get into a big deal in public. If you're home,
mm-hmm.
then I would recommend, again, this all depends on whether your button gets pushed or not. If you can stay out of that reactive mode, I think it's important to walk away,
mm-hmm.
leave the room, and say, I won't be spoken to that way. I'll be in the other room when you're ready to talk to me in a way I can hear. How old a child are we talking about?
This is my 5-year-old.
Right. Okay. Wow.
I know.
So they don't know. They don't know the meaning of the word, right?
Yeah. They just know the intensity.
Right.
Behind
and they
it.
Know, and they know how powerful the word is.
Yes.
Right. So in that case, with a 5-year-old, what I just said, I would recommend that for a little older child who
mm-hmm.
has a sense, knows what they're doing with the word. They're really throwing a barb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to let them know that you will not take, don't engage, don't get reactive, because then you're giving exactly what they're after. So you want to walk away. And
okay.
when the child says, you know, comes after you or doesn't leave you alone, then you can say, are you able to tell me what you want to tell me without using words that I don't like to hear? And the important thing about having abusive words thrown at you or abusive, physicalness, punching, kicking, it's very important that you feel secure in yourself and in your parenting so that you don't take it. And that doesn't always mean you're not going to allow the punch of a 3 or a 4 or maybe even a 5-year-old, but you want to make sure that they understand that that is not okay. And what I say to parents is to take your child firmly by the arms, not squeezing, just firmly, so they know this is, you mean business. Look them square in the eye and say, I will not be hit. It is not okay for anyone to hit me, and I certainly not hope that you will never allow anyone to hit you. And I would do the same thing with a swear word. I would say, I do not let people talk to me like that, and I certainly hope you don't ever let to you like that. Now, with a 5-year-old, tell me what kind of intensity, what kind of meaning you guess is behind that.
Well, you know, I need to take responsibility for my ownership.
Yeah. So your ownership,
okay.
Of what?
Well, I have sworn, so around
uh-huh.
him.
Okay, so he's picking, right, he's picking
yeah,
up.
Yeah, it's words. Picking up from me. So how do I rectify, like,
right.
How do I fix it? Do I make a rule? It's like there's no cursing in this house. And
I think anything.
Including mommy and daddy.
Yeah. Anything you forbid
mm-hmm.
is giving your child a loaded weapon.
Ah, okay.
So what you need to do is really own the fact that you don't like it. And
mm-hmm.
own the fact that you, too, have used words like that. And you are going to make a concerted effort not to do so. And you hope that he will, too. Because the reason is because people get offended when they hear words like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can talk to him about there are certain words that we use in our language that are very offensive to other people, and certain words that we should never use toward another person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for instance, what I did with my kids, they were older than this, 4 years apart, so maybe, I don't know, when my son was 9 or 10 or something, we started, or a little older. I said, because I'm in the same boat, my husband and I swear too. Now, obviously not all the time in front of our kids, but every once in a while there's a slip. And they're just words to us. You know, we don't have, I do believe that if you do not swear in your home, you
mm-hmm.
have every right to expect your child not to as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a rule of the home. However, if that's not the case, what we did with our kids was say, these words can be used at home only. And
mm-hmm.
we want to make, so when you give permissions, there are a lot of things we can give permission to our children to do. And when we give permission, then we can set these very strong parameters around them, and they will be cooperative with that. Because it's not like I'm giving you permission. I use that as, it's kind of like the title of what this whole piece is about, giving permission. It means I'm not forbidding. It means I'm saying this is okay only under these circumstances,
mm-hmm.
right? And outside the home, anywhere with anyone else, you know, Aunt Sophie would be very offended by that. Grandpa would be very offended by that. You know, list all your family members. People don't like to hear that outside.
Mm-hmm.
So, and typically that's helpful. Now, with your five-year-old, I think you want to just make sure that it's not reacted to, so you're not giving him a reason to use it, and see if it goes away of its own accord. If it's not reacted to, if a young child, certainly under five, is just using it because he's heard it around,
right.
and he wants to get a reaction out of you, you know, try not to pay any attention to it and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay. That's a long way around an answer to your question.
No, it was very helpful. It was.
Okay,
it was.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else have a question at this point? All right. Now what we're going to do is get into these beliefs that we hold and how they serve us. So when I hang on to a belief about myself, I am choosing to remain stuck. And part of taking responsibility is acknowledging that everything we do and say and what we believe is our choice. You know, how many opportunities you give your child and then you get angry because they're not appreciative of what you're doing for them, you're saying, in effect, you're saying, I'm doing this for you and you need to tell me how appreciative you are. So, in fact, there are a lot of strings tied to the opportunities. What you do for your child, what you buy for your child, what you allow into the house, everything is your choice. Even when your child is demanding, 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 and you get broken down and you give in and you finally say, okay, realize that it is your choice. It's hard to see that the beliefs that we take in about ourselves are our choice, but they really are. We perceived what our parents, teachers, whoever, were telling us in our own way and chose to believe what we did. And we did it for very good reasons. We did it to be safe in our family, to stay out of trouble, to make our parents happy. We did these things. We took in these beliefs about ourselves so that we could do and be who we thought our parents wanted us to be. We were innocent victims, and we didn't have an analytic brain at that time, and so we bought into it. But why is it we keep believing it? So we have a number of reasons. And what I would like you to do right now is look on page 33 in your workbook, and we're going to look at some of these reasons. So as you look over these, if anything comes up for you, if you have any thoughts, just write them down. So we think what we believe is the truth is one of the first reasons. That is the truth about me. And as we've seen in a couple of the exercises today, we don't realize that it's not the truth until we excavate it and understand what our parents' intention was on the other side of the gap. We don't change the beliefs we have about ourselves because there are no guarantees that changing is going to work, is going to change anything about me, is going to change what I do. We don't know what else to do. We don't really understand what it is. We don't pay attention to it. We don't have the time. We don't take time for this psychological psychobabble stuff. What is this about? We're very suspicious people. It's too hokey. And we want to pass the buck. We don't want to take responsibility. This isn't my fault. My parents made me this way. Or that often leads into what's good enough for me is good enough for my kids. If I think this about me, that's perfectly fine. So we don't trust ourselves. We don't trust that we have in us what it takes to do the work, and I think as Sheila was saying, she was really feeling very resistant to doing this work. I think there's a big part of that in there. You know, we don't trust ourselves. We don't want to look at it. We don't want to go there. We just want things to get better, and we don't want to do the hard work. So then we have the last two, which I want to take a little more time on. We are pendulum thinkers, and when I say we, I'm talking about human beings. That's the place on your page where it says, I'm afraid that I would have to be a completely different person if I were to change what I believe about myself. So, for instance, and maybe you want to write this down. Put your belief down on the left side of your paper. I'm not good enough is an example, or whatever you may have that you have come up with. Then draw a continuum line to the other side of your paper and write in what you think is the opposite of that. So what I put down for the opposite of I'm not good enough is I'm the best. So you want to really go to how would I feel if I felt totally the opposite of how I feel. So think about people who you know you have a perception that they think they're the best. Do you like these people? Probably not. We all know someone at the other end of the spectrum that we have strong judgments about. The other end seems vain or obnoxious or impossible. I'm stupid. The other end of the spectrum would be I'm brilliant. I know everything. That's impossible. You know, so we don't realize that we can simply take baby steps toward the middle, which is where I can accept that I am good enough. I am indeed good enough. We don't have to go to the other end. We don't have to go to that perfection stage. But this is how our minds think. And this keeps us in a stuck place. Well, I don't want to be like her, so I'm going to stay here. The other is the comfortable old shoe. It's who I am. I can just learn to live with it. This is who I am. This is familiar. This is who I have felt about what I've felt about myself for ages. It's who we've always been. These beliefs serve as our persona, our story. We've come to see ourselves in this light. We're under this spell. Maintaining a belief gets you to avoid doing something or allows you to keep on doing something. So if I believe I'm terrible at making decisions or I'm always wrong, I never get things right, that keeps you from what? Having to make decisions, having to come up with the right answer. You're going to pass that off to somebody else. So do you see how that is actually serving you? Somebody else can do it. I'm off the hook. This is called self-sabotage, and we all do it to some extent, some way more than others. The victim or the martyr might say, I'm always the one who has to do this. No one ever listens to me. I have to do everything. No one steps up. I take care of everything in this family. Well, that may get me pity, or I may get to show everyone how much I have to do, how important I am. Maybe it gets me admiration, or maybe it gets me people feeling sorry for me because of what I have to put up with. Do you see? We have these very subtle ways that we can create these scenarios for ourselves, make up these stories. I want you all to write down this sentence. If I believe I have what it takes to do what I want, then I'm faced with having to do it. I'll say that again. If I believe I have what it takes to do what I want, then I'm faced with having to do it. Many of us stay safe in our little comfort zones, inside our envelopes, because outside is just too scary. And so we don't get the opportunity to reach our potential. We don't get the opportunity to reach our capability, because we have learned that we can't. And that's why it's important to realize that these messages that I can't were coming from an authority figure who was reacting to their own triggers, their own buttons, to try to motivate us to be better people, to try to push us into areas that they couldn't go, perhaps, or projecting something onto us. You see, so they're not the truth. They're a perception, and it's very intangible. So we have gotten into a very safe place to be. In order to change what I believe about myself, I can create new pictures of myself, as Jill Bolte Taylor described in my Stroke of Insight that I mentioned last week. We all have our own stories, and many of us are more attached to their stories or addicted to our stories, especially negative ones, than others of us. That's the spell. So what's your story, and is it needing an overhaul? So think about being addicted to your story. Are you? Is it important that you stay where you are? I know it seems very, very, very difficult when you think about changing. But I think it's important to realize the context of where it comes from, of where your story comes from. What comes up when you think about changing what you believe about yourself? When you think of something like believing that I am good enough, I do what I do well, I have a hard time sometimes and need to ask for help. So many of us, especially, well, not especially women, men too, so many of us have such a hard time asking for help. I'm a capable, competent person. Can you say these with validity? I'm sure you all believe this about certain aspects of your life. But when you get defeated in parenting, doesn't it seem to permeate everything? And you forget about the better aspects of yourself and go into that negative self-talk. There's a lot of energy that goes into believing yourself to be a lousy parent or having a lousy child. Releasing your resistance to failure frees up the energy needed to succeed. Interesting. Any questions, thoughts? Yes, Sheila.
Okay, so I feel like I'm getting this right directed to me because it's exactly what's going on. So this is what I'm noticing. You know, when you said, oh, if you if I believe that I have what it takes to do what I want, then I have to do it. So
then I'm faced with having to do it.
Then I'm faced with having to
right.
do it. And then, so I go, totally get all of that. But the next thought that comes up is
mm-hmm.
this feeling of exhaustion.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's like I'm with you all the way up to there, and then this like intense exhaustion feeling comes, like, oh, you know. So how do I get around that? I mean,
well, what does the exhaustion come from? What is the assumption you're making about that statement that leads you to feel exhausted?
That there's so much to do. There's,
mm-hmm.
I have to organize so much. Either,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
not just my kids, that there's, you know,
right.
just, you know, just handling it all. And
right.
I even have help. So, I mean, I don't know what everybody else does, but, I mean, it's just like getting the papers where they're supposed to be and the, you know, what's for dinner and who's going where and folding my clothes, you know?
Okay, so it's important, Sheila, to realize that these are now at this time in your life, and I'm really glad you brought this up because I'm sure a lot of people are feeling this way, and this gives me a chance to clarify. Remember what I said about everything you do is your choice?
Yes.
So right now in your life, you are choosing to be a mom to your kids, you know, to do all the things that need to be done to raise your kids. It is not a time in your life when you're going to decide to go hole up in a studio someplace and become a famous painter or a writer, you know. This is the time in your life where your capacity, your capability is in the realm of parenting. If you have a job, then it's there as well. So what I want this work to help you be aware of is that these are the choices I'm making, and it's okay. I realize that I'm not doing all of what I want to do right now, but that's going to come later. Or can I do something? Do I feel stuck as a stay-at-home mom? Do I feel trapped? When in fact you do have the choice to work if that's your choice. You see, it also means doing a lot of things to make that happen. But when you realize that it's a choice, then you feel freer. You feel, okay, this is what I'm doing. So you have put a lot of time and energy into choosing what you're doing with your life. So when I say, if you believe you have what it takes to do what you want, then you're faced with having to do it.
Yeah.
What if what you want is being a great mother to your kids, and that's it? You don't have to be the great American novelist at this point in time, right? So if you want to be a great parent for your kids, then you want to look at what's in your way of doing that. What is preventing you? What is the resistance? What is the... It's even though you don't like a lot of the reactions you're having to your kids, it's easier, isn't it? It's easier to react. It's easier to just lay low. And do you... Here's the hard question. Do you get something out of believing you're not doing a good job as a parent? That's a sticky question. If you do believe that, then why? What is in it for you? Does that let you off the hook some way?
Yes, absolutely.
What hook does it let you off?
I think it lets me off. It's like, see, you really can't do it.
Uh-huh. So what you're doing is proving to yourself,
yes,
a belief that you took in about yourself a long time ago, that you're not good enough, you're not capable enough,
right,
you're not smart enough, right? Right.
Yes.
So that's the thing. That's how it serves you. It keeps you from having to do what you want to do. Now, yes, it feels exhausting to think about doing what you need to do. But that's because, again, we're pendulum thinkers. And you think, if you're going to do this, then you've got to read every parenting book there is, take every program, do spend all of your time thinking and working on your parenting, right? And in fact, all you really need to do is take one little baby step. One little baby step. But we don't think that's good enough. So if we don't think it's good enough to not do it all the way, you know, that's a catastrophizing.
Yes, and no wonder it feels so. It's like this huge weight on my chest. Like, just forget it.
Exactly. So it's a baby step, you know, and you're going to do your homework, as you said. Great. Do one exercise and stop. See what that feels like. Go, you know, we're talking about meeting your child where your child is at the time, setting your expectations for your child's success. It's also very important that you set your expectations for your success so that you're not expecting yourself to go out and take every parenting program there is. You're not expecting yourself to learn everything there is about a child's brain, you know? And you're ex- what you are expecting of yourself is that you're going to take one little step each day to do something that you want to do with or for your children.
Okay.
Does that feel less exhaustive?
Yeah. and then I have these expectations for myself, too. I mean, forget, leaving the children aside, just like hanging up my clothes or...
Exactly.
Or
having a clean house.
By my... I don't even have to have a clean house, but I have to have, like, some areas clean, like... You know, like I just have papers, and so I expect myself to have that together. You know, like
yes. And what does have
that?
And what does that having it together mean to you? What is the picture in your head of having it together?
Well, that I don't just like write something on a piece of paper and then leave it someplace and then I can't remember what notebook it is and then I have to go back and look through and then I tear the paper out and then I can't find it and, you know, like something that's kind of little like that or just taking off my clothes and putting them away.
So if you want to prove to yourself that you can't do that, then you're not going to do it.
Okay.
You see what I mean? If you really want to do that, then take a baby step.
Okay.
You know, the next time you write something on a piece of paper, put the consciousness to where you're going to put it. Or in your stack of papers that you need to file away somewhere, take one. Put one piece of paper away.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. I can do that. I can do that.
And when you don't, ask yourself, am I proving to myself that I can't do this? And what do I get out of that? What I get out of that is not having to do it.
Right. I know.
Okay.
That's really good. Thank you.
Good. Okay. When we hold on to these negative beliefs, they do reflect on our children. And when we focus more on the negative aspects of their behavior, what we're doing is focusing more on the negative aspects of their behavior than on the positive, right? So that's one way when we get stuck in those negative spirals of thinking. We're more focused on the negative of our children as well. When we're stuck in our limiting beliefs, it prevents connection because we're stuck in our own heads. When our beliefs drive us, when we have to prove them in some way, we unintentionally pass them on to do something, maybe subtly control our children and their decisions. Which undermines our trust in them, or we react to other people in our lives a certain way. When we become conscious of these limiting beliefs, and we can just kind of call them up and say, oh, yeah, there you go. There you go thinking you're not good enough again. That starts to change things. Now, remember, this is not about changing your backgrounds, wiping your childhood, you know, your childhood slate clean. It's about consciousness raising. So even though you may still hold on to these beliefs, you can become more conscious of them and make more conscious decisions. So it's about pulling those situations, as foggy as they might be when we took those beliefs in, out in front where we can see how we came to believe what we did across the gap. So when you can look at that, recognize that that belief was not the truth with a capital T, but in fact just a reaction from a distraught parent, then suddenly things change. Not only do we automatically begin to disengage from them, but we see how important it is to change what we do and say to our kids. As my friend Lou Hanesian says, unpack your baggage so your children don't have to carry it. So you are always a model for your child. I know on one hand I'm coming down with the responsibility of parenting. And on the other hand, I'm saying, lighten up. Take one baby step at a time. I can imagine it sounds confusing. The good news here is that realization is all it takes to make changes. You don't have to do more than simply be aware of the process. You know, like I was just talking to Sheila about, just pay attention to what it is you want and what you don't want and what your choices are about it. We get so bogged down in all that negative self-talk we do. And, like she says, the enormity of the project seems impossible. That pendulum thinking. So we stay where we are because it's safer, it's more comfortable, it's more familiar, it's who we know ourselves to be. But in thinking about this process, the examination that you're going through leads to raised consciousness, leads to more awareness, which then gives you more choice. When you pull it out in front of you and look at it, you have more choice about it. When you don't examine, it stays inside you and it drives you rather than you driving it. And when you have more choice, then you have more self-control because you know what you're doing is making a choice. This is the process of mindfulness, or as Dr. Dan Siegel calls it, Mindsight, which is the name of another wonderful book of his, Mindsight. What I want you to do, I want you to do homework, but I want you to just sit with this. Just let it kind of sink in and just see what comes up. Don't think you have to do anything. Don't think you have to start analyzing, although I do want you to continue to write down your assumptions and your emotions and your reactions and see if you can reframe your assumptions. You know, that's the practice work here. But don't get into this, oh my God, I have to completely change who I am. I think what I'd like to do is, before we stop, is just, because what you're going to do for homework is another and the last complete the sentence piece. And I think what I'd like to do, I haven't read the examples before because you have the homework, but I'm just going to read this one. I have identified a limiting belief I have about myself from childhood as sacrificing my desires gets me approval. Other people's needs are more important than mine. I am not important. I have this belief because my mother taught me to ignore my own wishes because whenever I talked about what I wanted, she told me I was being selfish. How that drives my parenting today causes me to never say no when I'm asked for anything, jump when my children want anything, and volunteer for too much, which keeps me from spending more time with my family, relaxing, taking care of my needs. What I get out of hanging on to this belief is believing that I'm making other people happy and getting approval for doing so much. This allows me to keep believing that I'm a good person and I'm worthy of being liked or loved because maybe I don't really feel that. Or maybe I don't feel that I deserve love. If I let go of this belief, I'm afraid that I will have to face being found out for being a selfish person and no one liking me. And then I will have to find other ways to be okay with myself, maybe have to admit that I'm not so perfect. Now, I predict that this is not going to be easy, and especially at the end, if I let go of this belief, I'm afraid that I will have to face. So I would suggest doing this as soon as you can, starting it. So you just kind of mull it over through the week rather than waiting until next Monday night or Tuesday morning to do this. See how that goes for you. And do that. And so the exercise is on page 35. And then there are questions about letting go on page 36. And the last practice, changing your perception, on page 37. And if you feel so inclined, and if you don't, that's fine, but if you feel inclined, write a paragraph or two about what your story is. See if you can write that down. What are the things that I believe about myself? That's really hard because it requires a fair amount of objectivity. And if you're reading, read chapters 18 and 19 and, you know, to the end if possible. Everything's pretty short from here on. So, that said, I